Those of you who have heard me preach more than a couple of times probably know that I am somewhat prone to political pontification. And you know also that I'm more than a little bit transparent when it comes to my leftist inclinations. And for the most part, you have been supportive of that. I know that you've been supportive because I get positive feedback after I preach political sermons, and because we've taken some surveys of the congregation. And there expressed in these surveys a general sense of satisfaction with, at least on balance, that the church is comfortable with a certain amount of political preaching. But there is one caveat. Over the 5 years I have been here as your pastor, a number of you have expressed concern about how we as a congregation can avoid being a left-wing version of right-wing fundamentalism. How do we avoid ideological purity tests? How do we practice hospitality in such a way that we can welcome anyone while still being a home for those who need a politically progressive church family? How do we stand firm on principle? How do we speak prophetically on important issues without ripping the fabric of society, a fabric that already is growing brittle and thin? How do we articulate our truth without encouraging the further fragmentation of the American people? How do we live with integrity without breaking off into a closed community that alienates everyone who disagrees with us? I don't know. But this sermon is an attempt to try to start answering those questions. It's only a start. But we have to start somewhere. So here we go. According to family lore, it came to pass that one evening, back when I was a kid, and my family was sitting down to dinner, there was a knock at the door. And standing out on the front porch was a man we knew. He had stopped by our house to challenge my dad to a fist fight as a way of settling a disagreement about how best to read the Gospels. Apparently, this guy subscribed to the belief that what's written in the Bible is sufficient, and that a person doesn't need any help to understand the Bible. A person just has to read what is written there plainly on the page, preferably in King James English. And our guest that evening, he didn't like the fact that my dad was reading books to help him understand what the Bible is trying to say. Now, I suspect that at least part of the problem had to do with the fact that my dad is smart. And the man who came over to duke things out with my dad, he didn't know how to articulate his opinions using words that made any sense. And he certainly wasn't reading any books that might have helped him formulate a cogent argument about why you shouldn't read books. So he came to our house to have a fight, which is something that my dad never would do, and I suspect he knew that. The would-be pugilist had spent time working for my dad, and socially they had friends in common. He went to our church, and for a time he even was my Sunday school teacher. Those of you who read what I write in the church newsletter or who follow me on Facebook may recognize the man I'm talking about as the same person who last week made sure that I understood that patriotic members of armed militia groups like him We're making lists of names and addresses of enemies of freedom. And they're going to round up those enemies of freedom and send them to Tierra del Fuego. And then he wanted to make sure I knew that I'd better get myself a warm jacket because I was going to be on that airplane. Incidentally, I wrote about this in our church newsletter, and Reno and Marjorie Nimi, two members of our congregation, happen to be in Tierra del Fuego right now, and they saw the article and they sent me pictures of how beautiful it is. So maybe it's going to be all right. I don't know. You know, this offer to send me on a free trip to the farthest limits of the earth, this offer came at the end of an argument about whether or not Jimmy Carter is a really real Christian, which is sort of alarming, right? Because how do you go from something about which there really isn't any legitimate debate to making such extreme personal threats? I don't know. And part of what's going on is that, of course, I was engaged online with the same person who more than 40 years ago came over to our house to challenge my dad to a fist fight over whether or not a person's belief should be informed by the reading of books. So of course he wanted to send me into exile because I think Jimmy Carter's life reflects profound and abiding faith. There always have been people like this, right? There always have been people who don't change even after decades of opportunities to change. Some people don't change. But what worries me is how the man's obnoxious and noxious attitude and behavior, it made me want to retreat into the embrace of like-minded souls. I wanted to get together with my posse, my gang. Bear in mind, it didn't make me want to go be part of a community. A community of people who would accept me and support me because they're my friends or my family or my neighbors. Community wasn't the thing. What I wanted to reach out to a squadron. I wanted to reach out to those with whom I have complete ideological agreement, and I wanted to go out and win a battle. Which is to say that I'm more like my old Sunday school teacher than I really would care to admit. And while I take full responsibility for that, I also suspect that the problem is way bigger than just me or the guy who wanted to send me off to the Straits of Magellan. I think our whole society is evolving in the wrong direction, which is to say we're devolving. We are in the process of becoming more like the guy I wanted to fight with my dad because my dad reads books. And we are becoming less like my dad, who refused to fight, and probably after the dishes were done and the kids were put to bed that night, he probably went and got a book to read. I'm really tempted to say that this problem of retreating into like-minded factions is a problem endemic to those who disagree with me, but I think that would be intellectually dishonest. And it would be spiritually useless. In a recent poll of Democrats and Republicans, those polled were asked what category of person the poll participants would least like to see their child marry. Right? And for Republicans, the answer was transgender people. That on average, that Republicans would least like to see their child come home and marry, announce that they were going to marry someone who self-identified as transgender. Do you know what it was for Democrats? What the person least likely? It's Republicans, right? I don't... Both answers are ridiculous, right? But they're not surprising. And if you know, we're not just dividing ourselves into Republicans and Democrats, right and left. We're actually dividing ourselves into ideological camps within our own sides, right? We're dividing ourselves according to factionalism based on purity of belief with those we used to agree with. You know, I was writing this sermon, a couple of good Berkeley liberals, a man and a woman. I think they might have been romantically connected to one another. They came into the coffee shop where I was writing the sermon, and they sat right behind me. This is why I wrote them into the sermon, by the way. I couldn't help it, because they sat right behind me and had this loud argument with each other while I was trying to write this sermon for you good people. So I had to incorporate their argument, but it was helpful because their argument was about whether Kamala Harris is qualified to be the president. Now, the woman in this couple, she liked Bernie Sanders. And the man, he wanted a female president. He wanted Kamala Harris, or at least Elizabeth Warren. And this dude was mansplaining to his partner about how she was a self-hating woman and an insufficient feminist for not supporting the candidate that he, as a man, had decided that she, as a woman, should support. And I see this happening all of the time on social media and on the pages and on the opinion pages of the various publications I read. As the next crop of presidential hopefuls starts to declare their intent to run for office, partisan bickering is getting intense. And the line between public policy and personal virtue, it's starting to blur and fade, isn't it? This worries me. Dividing ourselves even further into teams or factions of ideological purity, it's not good for us as a society, and it's not good for us spiritually as individuals, but of course, we do it anyway. And I'm as guilty as anyone of engaging in this kind of destructive behavior, so how do we fix it, right? The conventional wisdom says the best way to fix this division, this factionalism, conventional wisdom says the best way to fix it is this. Conventional wisdom says the best way to limit the damage done by extremist partisan bickering is for everybody to mellow out and meet in the middle and become centrists and to be moderate in all things. Now that's attractive and it's comfortable. But I have some problems with that prescription for what ails us. To begin with, centrist is a position that usually excludes voices that come from marginalized communities. Centrist often is code for ideas and policies that make straight, white, cisgendered, middle-class, suburban-dwelling Americans feel comfortable. But even if you can fix that problem, centrist is by its very nature and definition a moving target. It's defined by what's going on the extremes. So that the more that people like my combative ex-Sunday school teacher dominate conversations, the more they dominate the conversation, the more the center moves to the right. The more I dominate the conversation, the center moves to the left. Not that that's a bad thing. To make things worse, all of this, all of our definitions, everything we know about issues and politicians, the news of the day, it's all dictated by traditional media and then amplified by social media, and we are like the grass, blown this way and that way by bloviation, and it has the potential to drive a person crazy. And for that reason, I want to suggest that the Bible, something ancient and usually reliable in its wisdom, I want to suggest that the Bible might have something to teach us about not getting sucked into the temptation to break up into factions. And just so you know, I'm pretty sure, now I'm afraid that some of you might go, oh man, he was listening to that old Sunday school teacher because he's looking at the Bible for a solution. Well, I just want you to know that I'm pretty sure this old Sunday school teacher of mine would challenge me to a fight over how I'm going to use the Bible here. In fact, the sermon might not have even passed the generous orthodoxy test of my seminary preaching professors, but here's the thing. The Bible is filled with contradictions. Today's lesson from Luke contains a less famous version of what in the Gospel of Matthew we call the Beatitudes. A name that comes from the Latin word for blessed, because that word blessed is repeated several times in the passage. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed, blessed, blessed. And while a correct approach to preaching on this passage probably would involve a study of the word blessed and a systematic unpacking of why the poor, the persecuted, the hungry, the peacemakers, why are they blessed? I want to focus upon how this passage is different from the more famous version of it in Matthew. And more important, I want to talk about why there is a difference between Matthew and Luke's telling of what essentially is the same story. Here's the thing. Matthew and Luke do not agree on the details. To begin with, in Matthew, this passage is called the Sermon on the Mount because Jesus preaches it from a hillside. In Luke, in the words that Gene read to us, it's very clear Jesus is out on a level place, on the plain, right? So just to start with, there's a difference in geography. But more important, I want to focus on a couple of extra words that are in Matthew, but not in Luke. In Matthew, Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." In Luke, Jesus just says, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of God." In Matthew says, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness." In Luke, Jesus just says, "Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled." Matthew remembers Jesus speaking of spiritual poverty and hunger. Luke remembers Jesus speaking of economic poverty and hunger. And that's consistent. You know, there are similar differences between Matthew and Luke elsewhere in the Gospels. For example, Matthew has the Christ child greeted first by foreign magi, rich men bearing expensive gifts. Luke has Jesus greeted first by poor shepherds who have no gifts to give at all. Matthew's genealogy of Jesus has Jesus descended from all of the kings of Israel. Luke's genealogy for Jesus has Jesus descended from a more blue-collar line of ancestors. Now, some would say that the differences are either accidental or it's just a matter of Matthew and Luke remembering and recording different things that happened in Jesus' life. That could be, but I actually believe the differences between Matthew and Luke are intentional. I think Matthew and Luke had different attitudes towards wealth and different ideas about who should be afforded preference in the Christian church. And yet, thanks to the wisdom of those who tended to the New Testament as it evolved into its current form, both Matthew and Luke ended up in our Bibles. And for that, I'm glad. I'm glad because if there is room in the Bible, if there is room in the very Word of God for conflict and confusion and inconsistency, then, dearly beloved, there is room for me. And there is room for you. And there is room for my dad. And there is the room for the guy who wanted to send me to Tierra del Fuego. And for the woman in the coffee shop who likes Sanders. And for her boyfriend who wants a woman to be our next president. This is not to say that all opinions are equal. Or even that all opinions should be welcome. Because they're not welcome. No one is requiring us to embrace ideas that are hateful or illogical. It's not okay to fight over the Bible. It's not okay to make threats. It's not okay to mansplain. And I'm confident that a lot of my opinions are not that good either. But that's just the point. I think the way to avoid breaking up into camps of ideological purity is to acknowledge that every one of us is like the New Testament. We are inconsistent. We have internal dialogue. We have internal disagreement. And at any one time, we are of two minds on any number of issues. And once we've made up our mind on something, that well-formed opinion may not be consistent with how we think about another matter. Here's what I know to be true As much as we want the world to be divided up into neat categorical boxes, I know that a lot of Republicans who support small government and low taxes, a lot of Republicans support same-sex marriage and reproductive choice. I also know that abortion makes a lot of Democrats queasy, especially late in pregnancies, and they're afraid to admit it. I know that a lot of progressive folks struggle to wrap their minds around the idea that plural pronouns like they can be used in reference to a singular person. And one time I had a falling out with a friend who was trans, a trans friend of mine. We had a falling out when I called him out for being a Nazi sympathizer and for expressing white nationalist opinions online. A trans man. People are messy. I'm messy. You're messy. And the best way to keep ourselves from separating into destructive factionalism is to admit that we are all messy. There is no ideological faction that any one of us could fit into neatly or completely. Forget about establishing an entrenched camp and building a wall that keeps others out. We cannot even establish such a magical holy band for ourselves, a company of the pure. Even if there was a perfect social and political and religious team for us, a group that was just right, no one could ever last in such a place, because we change, we learn, we grow. Strict ideological categories simply cannot contain or constrain the honest. And you know what? That's okay. In fact, that's good. And if we remember that not even the Bible is consistent, not even Jesus agrees with himself all the time, then we can speak out powerfully and prophetically on things that matter. We can pursue righteousness in things political, religious, and social, while at the same time extending grace towards those who do not toe a line that we ourselves cannot toe. So, dearly beloved, be a righteous people. Be a holy people. Be a prophetic people. And know also that we're all a little confused, and sometimes more than a little. And let that confusion clarify how you think upon those with whom you have profound disagreement. Are they lost? Perhaps. Are they wrong? Yes. Are they dangerous? Could be. In need of correction? Probably so. But still, just another child of God who's trying to figure things out. Like you and like me. Amen.